Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. The Hamas-Israeli war, more than a conflict, it's a war now. It's more than 20 months long, but you know the conflict dates back centuries, right? After these brutal October 7th, this is 2023 attacks by Hamas in Israel. Claim 1,200. There are still hostages from that terrorist attack that are held by Hamas. And there is a lot of trouble in the region right now. I mean, it's shooken. Civilian losses in Gaza. There's outside powers now that could lead to a larger and more devastating outcome here. We're going to talk about that today. I mean, we've known the Middle East has kind of been a spark plug, but are we going to get a fire out of this? Director of UM Central and Southwest Asian Studies Center, University of Montana professor, Dr. Miradat Kia is with us. Once again, going to cut through some of this noise, inform on the latest developments, and answer your questions about the stakes and what might come next today on Voices of Montana. A pleasure to welcome. We'll get right into it here because there's a lot to talk about, a lot of focus on the war on terror as well, and especially since October 7th of 2023, the Hamas attacks in Israel. There's been a lot of things that have taken place since then, and I don't know if we're in a better place or not. Welcoming again, Professor and Dr. Miradat Kia, who is with us once more. And Miradat, I so much appreciate that. I look at your expertise in this area. I mean, you wrote the historical encyclopedia on the Persian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the modern Middle East authoritarianism. A lot of experience here. Thank you for joining us. I hope you're well.
Thank you very much, Tom, for your kind invitation. It's always wonderful to speak to you and your listeners, and it's really a privilege to have access to our listeners who might have questions, and I will be very happy to answer them if there are any.
Right, and we welcome those here. You can text us a message at 781-627-5483, or also call in, okay, 866-627-5483. Let's just set the stage, Doctor. Regionally, what is happening? What is maybe the most significant change since we last spoke in June of last year?
I think in the overall picture, you have a situation that we can talk about several so-called hotspots. But I think the biggest one is, of course, the conflict in Gaza, as you mentioned it correctly, and, the future of the area, because while the war goes on between the State of Israel and Hamas, which, as you pointed out, started with the attack by Hamas in October 2023, you also have another really sort of unfinished war, which is between Israel and Iran. So to set the stage, I think it's good to understand that you have two main players here. Israel more or less representing the Western interests, the United States and its allies, and Iran, which is pretty much a proxy or an ally, at least, of Russia and China. As I mentioned, I think in the last discussion we had, we are, really dealing with a new Cold War. This is different from the first one, which went on for decades after the Second World War, between Soviet Union and United States. This one is non-ideological in the sense that it's not between communism and freedom or free market economy and democracy, but it's actually between a bloc led by China and Russia against what they consider to be the Western bloc, United States, Canada, and their European allies, plus Japan and South Korea. In this one, you have, on the other side, aside from Russia and China, You have, of course, North Korea. You have the Islamic regime in Iran and a few other governments which are pretty much in that camp. And as the conflict unfolds between the two camps, you have, of course, United States and its European allies supporting Ukraine, for example, against Russian aggression. And, of course, Russia looking to cause as much trouble for United States and its allies in different parts of the world. And I am of the opinion that the support from Iran going to Hamas, for example, is part of this bigger picture. That is, while the war was raging in Ukraine, embarrassing Russia with its horrible military performance and having lost tens of thousands of its soldiers and officers on the ground, especially because of the heroic resistance of the Ukrainian people. On the other hand, you have Russia trying to cause problem, and the problem starts especially when the Arab countries are trying to make peace with Israel. And on the week, during the very week that Saudi Arabia and Israel are finally close to signing a peace treaty, you have Hamas attacking Israel in October of 2023. Mm-hmm. These are not accidental. Mm-hmm. These are attempts to prevent a peaceful settlement between Arab countries led by Saudi Arabia and Israel, which were very close to a final peace agreement. And, of course, we have to always train the source of money and arms. And the question is, who arms Hamas? Who finances Hamas? And when you look at it very carefully, you know, a country which has provided Hamas in only 1 year, $350 million, that's the Islamic regime in Iran, the picture becomes much more clear. So with military and financial support from the Islamic regime in Iran, Hamas wages an attack on Israel. Excuse me. Very brutal, very brutal attack. A large number of Israelis are killed. Large number of Israelis are kidnapped, as you mentioned correctly. Many Israelis still remain in captivity. Hamas is refusing to release them. And of course, the retaliation from Israel causes massive casualty in Gaza. And now we are, you know, on the verge of a human catastrophe, not only because so many Palestinians have died, it's also we don't know what will happen to Gaza, and over 2 million population of Palestinians who use Gaza as their home. And there are all sorts of alternatives on the table, but none of them seem to be that realistic at this point, at least.
How does diplomacy then, because with all those different players and all those different ideals and agendas, you know, how can diplomacy break out in I don't know. That's the question. How does diplomacy work or not work in this circumstance?
Well, I think on the one hand, we have to recognize that that the Trump administration, through Steve Witkoff, has tried to find a diplomatic solution by shuttle diplomacy, you know, going from one capital to another. And Mr. Witkoff tried initially and was very optimistic that he could actually find a solution. And the solution from the administration's point of view was a sort of a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. Hamas returns the Israeli hostages, and Israel basically allows Gaza to receive food and water and shelter and so on and so forth from especially various humanitarian organizations, but also various countries in the world, especially European countries. Hamas reneged on its initial commitment to the exchange, and several times Several Arab countries have jumped in, trying to convince Hamas. Right now, as we speak, representatives from Hamas are actually in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Egypt is one of the countries which tried to sort of convince Hamas to give up the Israeli hostages and return them. The other country is the Persian Gulf country, Qatar, where United States has a base, and it depends for its security on United States armed forces. So these Arab countries have worked on helping United States in finding a solution. But, of course, in the end, as we both know, the final decision is in the hands of the leaders of Hamas. And at the last moment, they have basically refused to go with the agreement. Part of it is, I think, is a serious fear on the part of Hamas that if they give up the Israeli hostages, there's no card that they can play. At least they think if they hang on to the Israeli hostages, they have a card to negotiate with Israel. If they give up the hostages, what is there for Hamas to give up? What I see, though, in reality, is that Hamas is pretty much finished. That is, yes, it has still remnants of fighters. You know, a fighting machine is still there. But completely reduced to a very minor force. And I think more importantly, there is no Arab country that I know of which is willing to support Hamas. Before, you know, there were a few countries here and there. There is only one country, and that's a non-Arab country, which still is willing to support Hamas, and that's Iran.
Dr. Miradot Kia with us here, we're going to go to the phones here. Dr. Kia, again, is professor of history there and director of UM Central and Southwest Asian Studies Center there. A lot of expertise in the Middle East, Central Asia, North Africa, and the Islamic civilization. Got some questions, so we'll go to the phones early on here. Bill, listening in East Helena, thanks for your call here on Voices of Montana today, and you're with Dr. Miradot Kia.
Well, good morning, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I think I have, might be a good solution, I don't know, to a couple of problems here in the United States. For years, they've been talking about getting rid of the United Nations out of New York. Well, how about if we just move the United Nations to the Gaza Strip? That way, they're in their little blue hats and their helmets. The United Nations Army can secure it, defend it, and supply it.
Interesting.
And that would get rid of the UN out of the United States, and that would put the peacekeepers in the most hostile environment on this earth.
All right, let's throw that. Let's throw that to Dr. Kia. And, you know, I think it's – Bill, thanks for that call. I think it's interesting to look at some of these potential solutions that you might hear and how they need to gain momentum. That's an interesting one, but I think I've heard that before too, and there's some sense to it.
I think, Bill, by the way, thank you for your call and your comment. I think that United Nations has proved to be completely irrelevant in terms of the conflict. And a large part of it is because of its own wrong moves as well as wrong approach. And, of course, the fact that it has become more or less a very large bureaucracy with very little appeal and impact on the ground. You look at UN and its presence between Lebanon and Israel, it would basically didn't work at all. You also have UN, at least for a time, between Egypt and Gaza, you know, where the Sinai Peninsula begins, and also proved to be irrelevant. even worse, I think, the situation was actually exacerbated by the fact that folks working for UN actually tried to help Hamas on the ground, and that really undermined the legitimacy of United Nations and actually provided Israel with the justification to not support UN operations on the ground. If you want to have a legitimate organization which plays a constructive role, you have to be really an organization which serves humanitarian purposes, not political purposes. And unfortunately, United Nations has adopted a very one-sided approach, and for that reason has lost any confidence or support from Israel.
As of August of this year, there's still around 70 to 80 hostages remaining in Gaza. Some have been confirmed killed. Extensive tunnel networks under civilian areas have been discovered, and the Israeli army has filled those in as much as possible. But we've known this, the schools, hospitals, mosques, they use those to store weapons. It's part of the conflict, part of the challenges of this conflict. We call it the Israeli, Hamas war or Gaza conflict, but it's been going on for a lot of years here. And as Dr. Miradad Kia is with us today, and I appreciate him coming along, professor of history as well, University of Montana, and director of UM Central and Southwest Asian Studies Centers, a well-known, distinguished expert in the Middle East. Skip, we'll go right to your question. Thank you for hanging on as well. We're at 866-627-5483. And then text a message or question here, 781-627-5483. Skip in Hamilton, KLYQ. Thanks for coming on today. You're on with Dr. Kia.
Thank you, Tom. And in conversation with us today, Dr. Kia he's like one of the treasure state's true treasures. Mm. We're lucky that we get a chance to learn what's really going on. And if you ever get a chance, anybody just listen, if you ever get a chance to see Dr. Key in person speak at a group or something, take the opportunity and go and get straight answers to your questions. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Kia, with what's going on in the Gaza Strip and Netanyahu's apparently wanting to just go in and just take over Gaza. That's what I've been hearing on the news the last couple of weeks. And then with the inference from broadcasters that he has to stay in power because if he gets unelected or if he loses his position, then he's in serious legal trouble for some of the things that and is there any truth to what's going to happen to him after it, or if he no longer maintains his, I'll call him, presidency? And is there something behind that, that because of some legal things that have happened that are going to happen to him? But anyway, thank you for coming on and tell us what you think about his idea about Gaza. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Skip.
Skip, thank you very much, first of all, for your very kind comments. I greatly appreciate it. And also, excellent question, which is really, I think Skip hit the nail on the head. I think we should ask about Prime Minister Netanyahu, a key figure in all this. I think we have to understand, first of all, that let's forget about the politics of Israel for a moment and ask ourselves, what if Prime Minister Netanyahu was gone tomorrow? Would Israel take a different stand? For example, if more centrist, because Netanyahu is more right to the center, if a centrist or even a leftist, prime minister came to power in Israel. And my answer is nothing will happen. In fact, on the left, and this might surprise a lot of people, the Israeli government, a leftist government, would be probably harsher toward Gaza and the Palestinians and Hamas especially than even Netanyahu government. Why? Because for the Israelis, it's not question of left or right. It's question of survival. Mm-hmm. It's a question of security. And the Israelis will tell you, and I'm, of course, putting it in a quotation mark, how many times I've heard it myself, we are crazy about security. This is a country which was shaped by horrible experiences, especially in late 19th and early 20th century, which culminated with the Holocaust and the extermination of over 6 million Jews. And this is the only place they feel is left for them to feel secure and to have a safe haven called Israel. So they will fight to the end in order to preserve it. And for that reason, it doesn't matter who is in power. Israel will not change its policy vis-a-vis Gaza and Hamas. But as far as Netanyahu is concerned, yes, he has legal issues. And as long as he is the prime minister, these legal issues cannot be carried out the way it would have been by his opponents in the government. However, I think it's more than just his legal problems that has convinced him to stay. I think it's a question of historical legacy. I think he wants to go down in history as a historic figure, as a person who basically neutralized any threat to the Jewish state, whether it comes from Hamas in Gaza or Hezbollah, the so-called Party of God in Lebanon, which is another proxy of Iran. And he wants to show to the Israelis that there is a way of living without threat to your existence. He has tried very hard to neutralize these threats. And I think part of the reason that he attacked Iran during the 12-day war was also to tackle another issue which every Israeli is very concerned about, and that is Iran's nuclear capabilities. Because if Iran became a nuclear state with weaponized nuclear capability, it would have tried to destroy the state of Israel. And Netanyahu sees it as his own legacy to go down in history as a person who finally ended that threat to the existence of the Jewish state. So it's, more complicated than it might seem in the end. But his legal problems are true or real. I think another issue related to the legal issue is when the attack happened in 2023 by Hamas, he misread the situation. Israel did not have sufficient number of troops on its border with Gaza, and there were questions in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, and I think those questions will come back as soon as he's out of power, and those can become another legal issue for Netanyahu as well. So it's a little bit more complicated, but the legal problems are very, very real, in fact.
I appreciate what he is trying to do there. I got to take a break, and we'll do that. A quick message from Brad in Lewistown, KXLO. And this is the question we'll maybe ask when we come on back, and it's flat out right to it. Is peace even possible there? Certainly has been a firecracker for a lot of years, the Middle East, this conflict. It's an East versus West. There's a lot of layers to this. We're talking about the Hamas and Israeli war going on now. It'll be 20 months, started October 7th, 2023. It was a brutal attack. And it wasn't just to go out and I hate to say it this way, to kill a bunch of people. They wanted to send a message at the brutality of it as well. And they did. And it disrupted things. There was a peace agreement that got thrown off the table at this point anyway. We are talking about this Hamas-Israeli conflict with Dr. Mehrdad Kia today. And I appreciate you joining us, Mehrdad, again. World-renowned expert in Middle Eastern and Southwest Asian studies. Well, actually, director of UM Central and Southwest Asian Studies Center. I'm going to give a list of your some of these publications because I talked about it earlier. The Ottoman Empire, a historical encyclopedia. The Persian Empire, another historical encyclopedia. Daily Life and the Ottoman Empire, the Clash of the Empires. Studied this and studied it. So I really appreciate your expertise here. So you're the one to answer this question, and it comes from Brad in Lewistown. Is peace even possible?
I think that, when we look at it from outside, of course, it's almost so complex, so overwhelming, and almost insurmountable. But peace is possible, and the reason it's possible is that there are a lot of people in the region. I think the overwhelming majority of the people who have suffered through war after war, that there is a sense of exhaustion on the ground, and there is a sense that we need to have a new era in the history of the region. The good news, look, I mean, during the first Trump term, President Trump managed to bring the so-called Abraham Accord. Mm-hmm. And immediately, of course, you had several Arab countries signing peace agreements, Morocco, Sudan, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and so on and so forth. And you saw the reception President Trump received this last visit to the Persian Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in United Arab Emirates. They view United States as their protector, as the guarantor of their security, especially against a bully like the Islamic regime in Iran. And they are negotiating to add to the list of the Arab countries which will sign a peace treaty with Israel. I think the key country will be Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is interested, very much so. And in fact, I think what we have now is a realignment in the region with all Arab countries more or less quietly, of course, not very publicly, but more or less siding with Israel in its conflict against Iran. I think the Arab world is far more worried about Iran than Israel. And for that reason, they see Israel actually as a counterbalancing force to Iranian hegemonic policies. So having said that, I think this realignment is a very good thing that is happening in the region. The other thing, I think the people of the region are waking up. And you look at Iran, just the last, I can tell you in the last 6 or 7 years, how many demonstrations, protests have erupted against this government. People in the government today have said more or less openly that 90-some percent of the population is against them and they want to remove this government. You have a population in Iran that is producing a very highly educated workforce. 57% of all university graduates in Iran are women. This is also a very young population, 70% below 35 years old. And they despise this regime. And they want a new future for themselves, for their kids. I don't know if you remember, Tom, but until 1979, Iran was the closest ally of the United States.
Yeah.
The majority of Iranians send their kids for university education to the United States. And that tradition still lives. I mean, if you ask 90-some percent of Iranians, where do you want to send your kids to get university education? They say United States, number one, number two, number three. So I think all those facts are on the ground, and they can work in the direction of making peace, but it's going to take perseverance, patience, and a policy that would bring our allies together rather than alienating them, which was unfortunately happening in the previous administration.
Well, the people there have certainly suffered regime brutality in over the years as well. I think we can appreciate that. I'm going to ask about this growing coalition. It's not real big, but of countries that want to recognize a Palestinian state. Yes. But I'm going to pick up on Iraq. Was Iraq a positive or negative lesson as the people of Iran right now are looking to possibly, if they could, remove their regime? Are they waiting for outside forces to do that? Maybe they need that. What do they see in the lesson of Iraq that applies to them?
Yeah, the two countries are very different. Iran is a very ancient country with its own very ancient identity. You know, we hear always in our history books about Persian Empire. You read the works of Greek historians like Herodotus. They were there at that point. They ruled a good part of the region. Iraq was created in sharp contrast to Iran. It was created in 1920s as an artificial country created by the British. So these are very different countries, though they're neighbors, and the only difference between them is an N and a Q at the end of their names. Iraq is a very different country, much more fragmented, much more disjointed, because they have a very mixed population. They have a Kurdish population in the north. They have a so-called Shia Muslim population majority in the south. It's a very complicated situation. I think the lesson from Iraq, though, is that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, though in a messy fashion afterwards, because we didn't have sufficient number of troops, has given Iraq an opportunity to move in a very different direction than it was moving under Saddam Hussein. And it has made some strides, and it has made some good changes. But still, the Iraqis are very divided internally because of religious identity, because of ethnic identity, because when the British created it, they didn't create a nation state. They created a country which contained several nations within its own boundaries, each with its own dreams and aspirations. So it's going to be a struggle, and I think a large part of the problem is also, once again, Iranian intervention in the internal affairs of Iraq. And this is why the Trump administration is trying to get rid of the Iranian influence in Iraq. They're trying to get rid of Iranian influence in Lebanon. And I think there is a realization in this White House that as long as the Islamic regime in Iran persists, survives, you're not going to have a peace, a permanent peace. And so, to answer to Brad's question, I think one big stride would be to have a real change inside Iran, and the region will start moving in the right direction.
I got about 4 minutes left here, and take all the time you need to answer this question, because it was news this week that Australia was going to, or threatening, or saying they could recognize a Palestinian state, although it doesn't exist. They're joining Germany, they're joining France, and that's a small coalition. Take us through the dynamics of that and how that impacts this.
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. Thank you for bringing it up. I think, first of all, politicians always look for something cheap and easy. You can recognize Palestinian state, but what are you going to do from Australia to make it happen? Nothing. Zil, nilch. But all of these leaders have political reasons. We talked during the break. For example, France. You have a government under Mr. Macron, which is highly unpopular. And its popularity level, it's in the 20s, lower 20s perhaps. So what is the cheapest and easiest way to gain a little bit more momentum and popularity or popular support? Islam is the second largest religion in France today after Catholicism. You have a lot of immigrants from countries of Middle East and North Africa, especially Algerians, Tunisians, Moroccans, in France. So how can you gain a bit momentum, a bit more popularity for your government, recognize a Palestinian state, and this Muslim, mostly Arab population, will come behind you? That's at least what Mr. Macron hopes. The same thing is true about the UK. You have a Labour government, which has been very unsuccessful, but it has a large Muslim population, this one mostly from Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. So how do you gain a little bit more momentum and support, show sympathy to the Muslim cause? And Palestinian cause is very much popular among the Muslim population all over Europe. So I see this as a political move rather than a real solidarity with the Palestinian people.
And those things are part of the game, I guess, or but they're not helpful in most of these circumstances here. Dr. Mehrdad Kia with us. You can see why he's one of University of Montana's favorite teachers, Distinguished Teacher of the Year, 97, Most Inspirational Teacher of the Year, 99, and also a U.S. Professor of the Year by the Carnegie Foundation, too, in the year 2000, just answering questions straight out. This may not be a fair question, but you'll probably get it from time to time. What's your prediction? And you don't have to go long-term. Maybe what's your prediction for the next year or 6 months?
I think. First of all, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's wonderful to speak to you and to interact with your listeners. My prediction is that we will have another open conflict between Israel and Iran, the Islamic regime in Iran, and it's not going to be soft diplomacy. It's going to be a military confrontation as long as the Islamic regime in Iran is aiming to have nuclear capability. Israel will see itself as responding to that. I think the Trump administration will try to negotiate or force a negotiated settlement with Iran. I don't think this regime is willing, though, to give up its nuclear capability. That's one. And the other one, I think the situation in Gaza will persist. And there have to be some very tough decisions made with regard to over 2 million people who have become homeless.
Yeah, there is a humanitarian crisis there as well.
And
those things exacerbate it, but also hopefully speed us to some kind of resolution as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mehrdad, thank you so much. I appreciate that. You got new school year going on here, right? Excited for that?
We are very excited, and this university has always been a favorite of mine, of course, and with so much potential and so much future ahead of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We'll check in with you frequently, okay? Because this is very, very important for us. Even though we're isolated here in Montana, this conflict, it could very well impact us, and so we're watching it. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you, Dr. Mehrdad Kia, once again. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.